children.
Call to order this meeting of the St. Lawrence County Board of Legislators Operations Committee. It is Monday, April 9th, 2018, approximately 5:30 p.m. I need a motion for approval of the agenda. Mr. Arquette and Mr. Perkins, Mrs. Bell. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. And I need a motion for the approval of the minutes of the March 12th meeting. Mr. Burke and Mr. Denisha. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And we're going to move to a resolution of the Board of Elections authorizing the chair to sign contracts requesting grant extensions for poll worker training and voter education. Mr. Perkins and Mr. Denisha.
I guess basically this is just the rollover of our annual grant to make sure we can have access to the grant funds. We use this for training our election inspectors and to get information out to voters to make sure we're improving our polling places so they're ADA compliant.
Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried.
I did have an update for the legislature. First, I'd like to introduce to my right here is Jenny's deputy, Gordon Ward. He's doing a great job as deputy. And as a follow-up to that, he and my deputy, Tom Hardiman, have been busy and continue to be, will be busy for the upcoming weeks and months. We're doing a big push to gain election inspectors. And we're asking your help also in that endeavor to identify good people in our communities who will be registered to one of the two major parties so that we can make sure we have enough people in our ranks to cover elections. Over the last 11 years, we have gone from almost 600 inspectors down to less than 360. That does not give us enough people to conduct a full election in November. So we're asking for your help. As you know, the average age has increased, and as that happens, we have had a number who have aged out of the system for various reasons, and I'll let you imagine what that is. But we have also, to help combat that loss of inspectors, for the first time in 11 years, we've increased the salary of inspectors, and we are notifying the legislature we've increased that to $160 for primaries and to $250 for the general election, which goes from 5:15 in the morning until around 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. We're also approaching high schools. The law allows for 17-year-olds who are pre-registered and a member of one of the two major parties to be hired as inspectors. So we are approaching our high schools, asking them to identify their best students who are responsible, are willing to actually detach themselves from cell phones for a few hours so they can be our election inspectors and work in polling places. That's the toughest part. It's a very difficult thing to actually get the cell phone detached from the student, but we're trying very diligently at that. Gordon and Tom and Jenny and I will be approaching civic groups, including Rotary and some other groups, asking them for their help. And Gordon actually brought a number of brochures. We're asking you to spread the word in your communities, and if you know of any young people or actually adults who are willing to be responsible and maintain the integrity of the polling place, to ask them to get a hold of us so that we can approach them and see if we can get them trained in advance of the primaries. We'd like, our theory is get their feet wet in some of the primaries in the spring and the fall, and then when it comes time for the gubernatorial election, which is going to be very, very busy, we're hoping they'll not feel quite so apprehensive and be able to help us this fall. As a rule, we're losing about 30 to 50 inspectors a year. So when we are out recruiting people, we might be able to get 10 or 20 per year. We're still losing on the average of 30 or more per election season. So we're hoping that you can give us a hand in identifying some folks to help replenish those ranks. Joe went right to work, and he identified his wife, and she got a hold of us, and she's going to be trained this year as an inspector. If you have people in your family that would like to be inspectors, we're more than happy to take them in. They can't work where legislators might appear in the ballot, but they can work in neighboring communities. And we're certainly willing to work with members of your families to make sure that we give everyone a chance to serve the public and help to make sure that elections remain free and full of their integrity. So with that, we're going to hand out some brochures, and if you have any questions for us, we'd be very happy to answer them.
Mr. Forsyth.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Good luck with the cell phone part. But
thank you.
The training involved.
Yes.
Can you give me a quick idea of how much training is involved? And
every year by law, every inspector must be trained in order to remain certified as an inspector. Our training for veteran inspectors is roughly 2 hours. For a brand new inspector, it's going to be around 2.5, 2.75 hours, depending on the questions they're asked during the class. But every inspector by law must be certified and attend training and successfully pass a test every year.
And they have to pass it. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Thank you very much.
Thanks. For the record, I just want to mention Mr. LaPierre is excused for tonight. And we're going to move on to a resolution modifying the 2018 budget for the Sheriff's Office to accept a 2017 legislative grant from the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services. Mr. Burke and Mr. Perkins.
This is a $30,000 grant that comes out of the Division of Criminal Justice Services and is earmarked for overtime money, to cover overtime money for the task force or something related to that.
Questions for the sheriff? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. And we have a resolution authorizing the chair to sign a contract with the New York State Division of Homeland Security for a fiscal year 17 Operation Stone Garden program grant and modifying the 2018 budget for the sheriff's office. Mr. Timmerman, seconded by Mr. Burke.
As you'll recall from seeing this, these in previous years, it's always a year lag by the way it's named. And that's why we have the funding year 17 on this. And you'll also remember that the money always is complex on how it's divvied up and given out. We do the reporting in regards to our office, the money that Ogdensburg does their own reporting, and then Norfolk Police Department will report back through us. And then you'll see that there's some other funds that are divided up among some other state agencies, but they do their own reporting, so that we don't have that requirement on it. But this is all designed on Operation Stone Garden to work in conjunction with Border Patrol in regards to, they're the ones that okay the original plans, are the ones that spearhead it. There's usually some equipment involved in it, but most of it's boots on the ground. That's the way it's designed. And so any overtime where we're working with them or working with them in conjunction with something that turns into overtime, then they reimburse us for that.
Questions? Seeing none, all in favor? Opposed? Motion's carried.
If I could have a couple minutes.
Yes, sir.
Just to give you an update on jail count. Jail count's been running now for several months, probably about 30 bodies lower than what we did for several years there. So count today, when I came over here, is 133, 28 of which is females, which is still kind of running high if you look at the comparison, the percentages. Running a little high there. Tonight, the Sheriff's Office and the State Police are at Madrid Waddington Central School for a school safety discussion, open auditorium, and it includes, the invites went out to the Hewelton School District, Lisbon School District, and Madrid Waddington. And so we're there and we're part of that tonight. We had a pre-meeting last week to make sure everybody was on the same page as to what the school expected, what they were looking for us to accomplish for them. So it won't be like an active shooter drill or anything like that. It's an actual public. You get to hear the school's safety plan, and you get to hear a few other things. And we won't be giving out details of response or anything like that, but we'll be there to answer questions tonight. So that starts at 6. So if you see me take off as soon as we finish, I'll go over to that. I spoke to a couple of you the other day at vacancy committee in regards to a possibility of a vacancy coming up with a road deputy, and that looks like it is going to happen. So I'll t- hop back on the process and try to get that filled. Did an interview today with WWNY that Mr. Denish and I did separately, but that was in regards to Amish buggy accidents and cars and encounters. And what prompted him to show up, I think, and ask questions was because we did have one this morning at the beginning of the day on Old DeKalb Road. Nothing that a triangle would have prevented. If there had been a triangle on it, on the buggy at that point, it wouldn't have prevented it. It was, you know, it was speed related and a blind hill. So you come up over the hill and there's something in partially in your lane of traffic and you aren't able to react quick enough. So there was probably some minor injuries, but nobody accepted treatment. Everybody signed off, and even the horse survived it. So made it through that one. But that's what prompted, I think, that interview and from the WWNY reporter. So unless you have questions of me, that's all I have. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Sheriff. Moving forward, we have a resolution modifying the 2018 budget to establish appropriation and revenue accounts for a community development block grant award for a countywide housing rehabilitation program. Mr. Burke and Mr. Perkins.
This is one of many successive awards now. You see the number 49 at the end of the code for the accounting. We've been very fortunate as the state has come back that we continue to win awards. This is for a second round of a countywide housing rehabilitation program. We expect to serve about 23 units and be able to provide for program admin and delivery services through a contract agency and get this expended within a two-year period.
Questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Next, we have a resolution and some information adopting the assessment of fair housing St. Lawrence County 2017.
One of the obligations of these.
Bell and Mr. Perkins.
I got all excited. One of the obligations of these federal grants is to affirmatively advance fair housing. We have been doing this for a very long time, but the federal government keeps changing the way it wants this assessment and work to be done. It used to be called impediments to analysis of impediments to housing. It's now a fair housing assessment. I'm going to invite John and Matilda up to talk about how it was performed, but suffice it to say, we're well in, within our compliance envelope for this. We have a surprisingly good compliance report. There's always work to do, but I think you'll be pleased with how we're doing and also recognize that there's still challenge out there in the landscape. John, Matilda.
Thank you. I'm John Tenbush, and this is Matilda Larson, and we are both with the County Planning Office, and we both staff the Fair Housing Task Force. As Keith mentioned, the Fair Housing Task Force is a requirement placed on the county by the Department of Housing and Urban Development in order to qualify to receive community development block grant funds. And we have received over the years more than $24 million in such funds for both housing rehabilitation and for home ownership assistance. We have complied with this requirement by establishing the county, established the Fair Housing Task Force in 1991, and the task force has operated ever since. And on a personal note, I'd like to thank you for approving a resolution last week to declare April as Fair Housing Month. This is actually the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Fair Housing Act in 1968. And so your resolution couldn't have been more timely. Matilda?
As Keith mentioned earlier, the Fair Housing Task Force has conducted assessments or analysis of housing issues in St. Lawrence County. And just a few years ago, they did change the criteria for how we look at the assessment, how we conduct the assessment. Because we were not so familiar with the criteria at the time, And because we know that there are very many other communities in the county that do pursue community development block grant monies for their home repair programs, we partnered with the five population centers to pursue this project. And we contracted with Fair Housing CNY out of Syracuse because they are most familiar with state and federal fair housing requirements and enforcement actions if necessary. When this particular study was done, it was completed by way of collecting a bunch of census data. And a lot of what you're, some of the highlights that you'll see from the report came to fruition by a kid named Dylan Arpey who graduated from St. Lawrence University. This kid was able to grab census data that was readily available on their online databases, but create tables that we were able to import into our mapping program. This wasn't readily available through the Census Bureau because, why? We live in such a very rural area. It wasn't done for the entire community. Dylan was able to pull that off and did such a great job. He pulled it off as part of a senior project. So we used our census data. We did some interviews with landlords, realtors, municipal code officials, a justice, service provider representatives who assist those with disabilities or are in the Office of Aging, working with those who are economically disadvantaged and live in affordable housing complexes. And then we also met with community officials and municipal planners. Through that whole process, the report was put together and it was drafted in November, and then a public outreach forum was held at SUNY Canton later in that month.
Some of the highlights of the report, as Keith mentioned, we have a very good track record with our Fair Housing Task Force. The state of New York sends people to talk to us when other counties, especially other rural counties, want to do some fair housing work, because the state recognizes, the Office for Community Renewal recognizes that we do a good job. But there is always room for improvement. There is always more to do, primarily in the field of education, educating the general public and then educating specific target markets in the general public, landlords, real estate folks, tenants, service providers who help people with different issues. The over time, the protected classes that the Fair Housing Act covers has grown and expanded. The federal protected classes include race, color, and religion, national origin, sex, disability, and familial status, in addition to which New York State requires fair housing law to cover creed, age, sexual orientation, marital status, or military status. Now, in St. Lawrence County, we don't have a lot of the typical fair housing issues, because most of us think of fair housing, we probably think of issues of color, issues of race. We don't have that because we are a predominantly white community. What we do have is issues of equal access to housing through socioeconomic issues and through housing conditions. Overwhelmingly, low-income people end up in low-quality housing. And at what point does that low-quality housing violate their right to habitation? Especially for renters. If I rent from you, there is a presumption that the unit is going to be habitable. It'll meet code. And if it doesn't, that's an issue. Sometimes that's a straight-up landlord-tenant issue, but sometimes it gets close to fair housing, equal access. People with disabilities, women with children, and those are some of the protected classes that we end up seeing more often than not. So housing conditions, if we had good housing all throughout the county, we'd have a lot less problems with fair housing. We have come up with a number of policy recommendations, and they're listed, so I'd just like to mention them briefly. We want to make the code violation process easier to enforce. That will help us to deal with issues of poor quality housing. Code enforcement officials tell us they are hesitant to condemn a unit because they think they will be putting that family, that household, on the street. And today, that very well might happen. But we think that there are ways that the code enforcement system can be revised, and we'll work with the code enforcement officials and with the justice system to figure out how to do that. Some other communities have gone to, for example, a ticketing system that might be applicable here. We want to expand the use of rental registries. Potsdam has one. Does Ogdensburg have one as well?
Yes.
Canton has discussed one. So in some of the larger communities, those rental registries give some assurance that a housing unit is going to meet code. We want to continue education. That has been pretty much the primary focus of the Fair Housing Task Force, education workshops for all kinds of people. We want to continue that and expand it. We all might have heard about the situation that happened in Ogdensburg last year when they got into trouble with, I don't remember the name of the organization, but it was a home for disabled people. Disabled people are a protected class. Had they been aware of that up front, their position might have been different. We'd like to forestall those kinds of problems and issues. Education will help us do that. We always need more housing funds in order to continue the work that we're doing on housing rehabilitation and home ownership for low-income people, but also to address housing needs of particular populations, including people with disabilities. We'd like to streamline the application process for funds. There are 100 different programs, and each one has its own application. If there are some ways that we can make that application process a little bit more common between agencies, that'll just help people navigate the process. And finally, we'd like to figure a way to establish some sort of housing preference for some of our most vulnerable populations, including victims of domestic violence and veterans. So that's the highlights of the assessment of fair housing. It's available from the county's website. If you go to the planning office and you look at advisory boards, you can find Fair Housing Task Force, and the draft plan is available on that site. Or fairhousing.stlawco.org. Those are two ways to get at it. Now, Matilda is going to talk to you about some of the mapping and data gathering that we've done.
Right. These are just some of the highlights that are that come from the assessment. And the first slide that you see in front of you is essentially a breakdown of all the municipalities in the county. And the purple lines superimposed over it are the census tracts. You will note that in some of the population centers, these towns have more than one census tract. That applies to Messina. It applies to Ogdensburg. It applies to Canton, and it certainly applies to Potsdam, which has 5 census tracts. But as you get into the Adirondack Park, you find that there are towns within a single census tract. That certainly is the case for the towns of Clifton and Fine. Oh, no. Towns of Clifton and Fine, the town of Clare, the southern portion of Colton, and Piercefield. That's a big example of census tract 4925. That's just to give you an idea of what you're going to be taking a look at in the subsequent slides. Work. There we go. Sorry. This particular slide shows you the distribution of occupied housing units in 2014. The darker the color is, the higher the concentration of housing units in that particular census tract. The towns of Pierpont, the northern portion of Colton, and all of Parrishville represent the highest concentration, followed by the southern portion in the town of Messina. Other towns that are pretty dark are Edwards, Russell, Pitcairn, Fowler, and the town of Governor. This shows you the distribution of renter-occupied housing tracts, and this shouldn't come as a surprise. Most of those correlate where? In your population centers, Canton, Potsdam, Ogdensburg, Governor, and Messina. One little interesting surprising note is 59% of a particular census tract in Potsdam, renter-occupied, college town. This particular slide shows you how old the housing stock is for those census tract. The date that you see inside the middle of that census tract tells you the halfway point of the housing stock in that community. I'll pick on the census tract inside the Adirondack Park, 1955. That means 50% of all houses in that particular census tract were constructed before that date. The other half was after that date. So where is the oldest housing stock? Ogdensburg. Median year for one particular census tract in Ogdensburg is 1939. You also find a very old number for the northern portion of Messina, 1944. So the darker the shade, the older the housing stock. This shows you the distribution of mobile homes throughout the county. In 2014, there were about 5,700, almost 5,800. The highest concentrations were found in Brazier and Stockholm, as well as in Russell, Edwards, Pitcairn, and Fowler. More than one out of every five homes in those communities was a mobile home. This shows you what HUD and the Census Bureau considers to be overcrowded housing conditions. That means more than 1.5 persons for every room in that particular home. The darker the shade shows you the higher overcrowding situations. It does not come as a surprise for Canton and Potsdam because student housing. Lots of kids will room together when they're renting a house. Where you do find the second highest concentrations are in DePoyster, DeKalb, and Herman, followed by Macomb and Morristown. Now we're going to get into how much money a household spends on housing costs. In this particular slide, these are households where they spend between 30 to 50% of their annual income on housing. So the darker the color means that there's a higher percentage of households in those communities that have to pay more for housing expenses. The highest came in out at in the town of Governor. More than one out of every five households in that particular community spends between 30 to 50% of their annual income on housing. This particular slide will show you households that are spending more than half of their annual income on their housing expenses. In the Adirondack Park, more than one out of every 10 households is paying more than half of their annual income. Same could also be said for the towns of Hammond and Rossi. So the lighter the color, it's a less prevalent issue, but the darker the color, it is a more prevalent issue for those particular census tracts. And then lastly, we're going to get into the distribution of households that have a disability. This particular slide shows you the concentration of persons with a physical disability and have difficulty getting in and around their home or in and out of their home. Higher concentrations in the Adirondack Park census tract, more than one out of every 10. It's also very high in and around Messina, Brazier, and Stockholm. So that's for physical disabilities. This shows you where resources need to be focused to help make the modifications so that people can continue to reside in and around their homes as well as in their communities. This slide shows you those individuals who have a developmental disability and may need access to supportive housing. And again, it should not come as a surprise to see higher concentrations in the population centers. Most often the nonprofit service agencies are located in those areas, so the populations may be higher because it's easier access to those services, or it may be tied to the fact that you have affordable housing complexes located in those census tracts where persons with developmental disabilities may reside. So those are just a few of the slides that we included in this year's assessment. And we just wanted to bring those to your attention. Those are the issues that we're trying to address in this particular plan by the continued pursuit of resources, as well as the continued advancement of public service announcements and public outreach and education. Thank you.
Are there questions for us? Yes, sir.
Matilda, when you were stating the median age of the properties in Augsburg, do they take into consideration the high towers and Belmont and everything? Everything's considered into that fact there? The high rises? Boy, that would seem to skew the number, then, I would think. But.
Well, for the units in that particular building?
Yeah, they would.
I think it's just building.
Mr. Akers.
Well, John, I think I know a number of people that do rent, and they probably are discriminating on the basis of what their perception is of their potential renter's ability to pay. Could you speak to that issue? So, and you want more detail or something. So, whether it's, it's an incoming family where there may be three generations, that type of thing, or certainly women with numerous children and maybe more numerous boyfriends, that type of thing, which I would say that probably in many of these incidents, these families or whatever are known to the people that own the homes. So I think it's, I guess what I'm saying is, the landowners, by refusing to rent to them based on what their assessment of whether their ability to pay is, or and how regular their pay for that monthly rent would be, would determine whether or not they would rent to that. So I'm playing the devil's advocate. What's a landowner to do, or a home, a renter to do, somebody who's renting out their property to this particular base, what are they to do in reflection of what you're trying to do?
Well, I think that we need to differentiate between landlord-tenant issues and then fair housing issues. If there is a tenant that you feel is undesirable for your unit, that doesn't fit your unit, maybe because they have too many people in the household, then there's no requirement that you rent to them. But we as a society need to make sure that there is a place for people with large families or people with only single parent head of household, that there's a place somewhere for them to rent. And so at some point we need to work with housing providers, we need to work with renters, landlords and other places, and help make that mix happen. Sometimes it's better for us to help a family get put into a home that they own, and we do have a home ownership assistance program for low-income people. So a low-income family with a number of children would tick a couple of boxes on that program and make them more attractive, if you will, to that program. And that's helpful to everybody. Then they have equity, then they can build some wealth, and they're also not in the rental market because their family size is such that it's going to be hard for them to rent.
Are there systems in place in the county now that are addressing those issues where those type of conflicts come into play?
Yes, but those systems can always be better coordinated. Right now, it's a little bit slipshod between one and the other, and for good reasons. If I've taken your application, there's a confidentiality that's required of me. I can't go talk to somebody of another agency. Hey, I know these guys. I can't do that. So we're looking for ways to improve that level of coordination, so that if I do take your application and I'm aware of that other program, that I don't have to just send you over there and you start from scratch. There's some way that we can make that information transfer a little bit more seamless.
So is there a place for say potential tenants who can't get anybody to rent to them? Is there a complaint system or something? Who do they notify? Like, I can't find a place to live. Nobody will rent to me.
There is not a place, an agency that's open. The St. Lawrence County Housing Council frequently gets questions like that. We will oftentimes, if we get a question like that, we will send them to the Housing Council because, as you know, the Housing Council operates our housing rehabilitation and our home ownership assistance programs. So if we can get them slotted in one or another of those programs, then we've helped them. We have some information about some other agencies around the county, the Messina Independent Living Center, and they don't call it that anymore. But there are some other agencies that work with different populations. So depending on the circumstances, we might be able to help. But we can always improve that, and that's one of the things that we want to do.
So none of your slides showed anything about homeless people. Of course, they don't have a residence. They don't have an address.
Do we have any other slides in there?
It is a very difficult statistic to try to track down reliably across the county. And most often, it's because you don't see truer homelessness in the county. It's near homelessness, where they are cohabitating with another family or with friends. They're not out on the street.
Okay.
And that is harder to track.
Okay. Has there been an effort on this county's part to track that, or on a state level? Or
there's a tri-county homelessness program. And Chris Reese, you might know the name of it?
Points North Housing Coalition.
Thank you. And so that is the vehicle that has been used for over 10 years to get a handle on the issue of homelessness.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Forsyth.
Well, I was going to follow on. I think Chris has spoken about Points North before, and Matilda's dead right. It's a near homelessness problem in St. Lawrence County. It's tough to address. We are the agent that if somebody feels they've been discriminated in their housing choice, they would come and complain to. We are required to investigate. We do an investigation. We write a report. We'll follow up. We don't have a lot of overt discrimination. I will say it's gotten better over time. When I first came here, I was gleefully told of a blacklist. That's just a really terrible idea. If you know anybody who has one, they should burn it, even though burning's not a good idea.
There still is one. There were reports of blacklists in a couple communities in St. Lawrence County when we were doing this study.
And that's a very dangerous position to be in as a landlord. You don't want to ever be accused of being a blacklister because that's just overt discrimination. One of the problems with what you just described, Kevin, at the beginning, is you're judging a book by its cover. I mean, to a certain extent, it's like refusing service in a business for the same reasons. You'd be hard-pressed and probably sorry if that came to court. And so I think people need to be careful. There is always a remedial process, and unfortunately, it has a heavy due process burden for the landlord, but that's just the way the system is set up. But by the same token, we've also helped landlords with the very question of how do I evict a deadbeat tenant? How do I deal with a problem who's damaging a property occupier, who's damaging the property? It really works both sides. You know, we've had complaints from people who have trouble finding housing, and we've had complaints from people who say, I've got people abusing their housing and I need them to get out.
And we've actually had workshops
on both sides of that equation. So we view fair housing as being fair not only for the occupant, but also fair for the property owner or the landlord. So we work hard on both sides of that equation. I'm sorry.
The issue that I'm running into in my business lately is the aggressive dogs on these lower income that will have the pit bull or the Rottweiler, you know, be on the hit list per se. How do you treat that if that pops up?
We don't.
Stay right away? That's a landlord-tenant issue?
Yes, that is a straight landlord-tenant. There is a question of service animals. Service animals are people who require service animals, they are a protected class. But
being a protected class, would the landlord be entitled to a certificate showing that it is issued by an issuing agency, that it is technically a service animal and not just someone saying
you're
it's
asking me a legal question and I can't answer that.
Okay, because that's the loophole that seems to be popping up lately. No, it's service dog.
Right.
Well, show me the service dog papers.
Yeah.
And I actually think that at the federal level, the policies are being revised to address that particular use. I mean, there are tenants who legitimately require service animals, but I think that at the federal level, they're recognizing that it needs to be addressed.
Okay.
I did send a memo out, and Kelly was kind enough to post it today to your share drive that has the links to the report and the support documents that go with it. So you don't have to remember those web addresses that John gave you or how to peck through the website to find it. And we do appreciate your support. And I appreciate the work of the Central New York Fair Housing Group and also John and Matilda in putting this together with the Fair Housing Task Force.
If I might say one last thing. The Fair Housing Task Force, since this month is Fair Housing Month in St. Lawrence County and it's the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Fair Housing Act, the Fair Housing Task Force is putting on a number of presentations in communities around the county. At present, we have three scheduled. The first is tomorrow, April 10th, the 50th anniversary, in Potsdam. And we have one scheduled for SUNY Canton on April the 30th, and one at the UU Church here in Canton on April 26th. And there's one at St. Lawrence University on April the 16th. And we're in discussions with a couple of other sites put on presentations there. These presentations are basically films, short films and documentaries that we've pulled from the internet from different sources on issues of fair housing and civil rights, because fair housing came out of the civil rights struggle. And we're pretty pleased that's coming together.
Mr. Akers.
Would you email what you just said to the legislative body?
Yes, we have
the time, place.
I'll email that to you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Denisha.
guess the question that comes to mind, we're going to have, with the Fair Housing, we're going to have an event at Canton College, we're going to have one at St. Lawrence, one at Potsdam, another one in Canton, I believe. We've got a whole, that's about the 175th of the county.
I've had discussions with the village of Messina and with the city of Ogdensburg. I've also spoken in Waddington, because that's where I happen to live, so, and I know where are places where we could have that. We would be willing to talk with any site in the county that that where we can get a decent internet connection, and it would be willing to promote the presentation.
If I may. Okay, let me suggest the Clifton Fine Community Center.
All right, I'll get in touch with them. I'm out of the office tomorrow, but I'll be in touch with them on Wednesday.
And that would be Hope, right? Hope Dolan? Yeah.
I love that place.
Any other questions or discussion? Seeing none, as to the resolution, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And thank you, Keith,
thank you all.
John, and Matilda. And we're going to move on to a resolution authorizing the chair to sign an agreement with the Canton Chamber of Commerce for use of the parking lots at the H.B. Smith Building and the courthouse for the annual Dairy Princess Parade. Mr. Forsyth and Mr. Akers.
As Mr. Hooper said, this is the annual resolution we do to allow the chamber to use our parking lots for the setting up of the parade.
Questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. And we have a resolution authorizing the chair to sign a contract with Troy and Banks Incorporated for utility and telecommunication auditing services. Mr. Lightfoot, seconded by Mrs. Bell.
Thank you. This contract would be for an audit of our utility and phone bills, along with some recommendations for savings from Troy and Banks. The contract will be based on a Rockland County bid award that pays Troy and Banks 24% of any refunds they get, and they would also get 24% of any first year savings from any savings recommendations that we do accept and choose to implement. A lot of times over the years, I really haven't had an awful lot of good luck doing these utility audits, and the companies that have approached us have asked, you know, for pretty high percentage of the savings, usually about, you know, 50%, usually it's usually a 50-50 split. And I think there's four reasons I'd like to recommend the Troy and Banks contract. First of all, I think the 24% fee is a very fair and equitable fee compared to what, you know, we've seen in the past. Also, my dealings with them so far, they've been very organized in their approach to the audit, and they seem very professional and experienced in doing the audits. They have a track record of getting six-figure refunds from municipalities. It seems kind of high, but I've seen the data on it there. They have had success, you know, from some of them much larger municipalities, but definitely some success. And I think the other thing is, I'm actually very interested in seeing what they come up with for recommendations. In my mind, their company has people that used to work for the Public Service Commission, for telephone companies, for electric companies, and different things like that. And to have them come back with some recommendations, to me, is kind of, you know, some free consulting by some very experienced people. And I think if it's something that we're not doing now, I think it'd be worth, you know, the 24% of the first year savings, because we'd have that savings going forward. And I'd, you know, answer any questions that anyone would have.
Mr. Akers.
So if there's no savings, there's no fee.
That is correct.
Okay, so what types of things are we looking for? Are we looking for like an extension cord and running across the street powering our county attorney's house or something of that nature, or something less obvious?
Actually, you know, obviously it's things like do we have electrical accounts or telecommunication accounts that don't exist, you know, that we're actually getting charged for things. You know, those things do happen. In terms of electricity, you know, it could be things like rate classes being wrong, and things like that. Like I said, in the past, we haven't really had any luck finding refunds, but, you know, like I said, when you see, you know, what they've done in other places, I think it's worth a try. And one of their things that they really stress is that they're not, they want to make the audit as easy as possible on the municipality. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of work on our end, but it's not like we're going to be doing all the work.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried.
Great, thank you.
And finally, a resolution for authorization to fill a building maintenance worker position in the governmental services department. Mr. Arquette and Mr. Forsythe.
This is to replace a building maintenance worker that recently retired. You know, the building maintenance workers are the staff that are actually out doing the building repairs and things like, you know, painting, remodeling, any projects we do, like similar to like what we did out to Board of Elections and things like that. Those are the building maintenance workers that are actually doing that actual work.
Questions on this? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to move on to a resolution authorizing the chair to sign a contract with the Development Authority of the North Country to install dark fiber to tower sites as an interoperable communications resource. Mr. Burke and Mr. Paquin.
Okay, this resolution would authorize the chair to sign a contract with DANC to provide dark fiber connection from our tower site in Messina to the backup, as well as to our tower site in Ogdensburg, back to connecting it back to the PSAP here. This is again a redundant form of communication. Should when we get our microwave system set up, and if there was a failure in that, it provided a redundant form of communication. The reason when we went with DANC was several years ago, DANC had gotten a contract, a grant from the state to provide dark fiber to public safety answering points around the state. This would be an extension of that, and I was able to secure, because of that initial grant, I was able to secure sole source permission from Grants Administration to use grant funding to support this project. So for those of you who are familiar with the MWBE requirements that are a hurdle for me to accomplish, the sole source money comes off of that, the discretionary amount, and I don't have to report that as part of the grant funding for MWBE goals.
Mr. Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like, what is dark fiber? I know what fiber optics is, but what is
right.
dark fiber?
So it's basically it's a fiber connection. It's just not lit. So we're paying DANC up front, and the way the contract reads is it won't be lit until such time if we need it, and then there's no additional charges after that because I'm paying them up front.
Other questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Thank you, Mike.
Yep.
And we're going to move on to a resolution for authorization to abolish two senior motor vehicle clerk positions and create and fill a motor vehicle clerk position and a motor vehicle supervisor position in the Department of Motor Vehicles and modifying the 2018 budget for the county clerk's office. Mr. Akers, Mr. Forsythe.
We have a motor vehicle senior clerk position that's going to be vacant as of May 25th. I would like to eliminate that position and create a motor vehicle clerk position and then move the remaining senior clerk to a motor vehicle supervisor position.
Mr. Lightfoot.
And this resolution is going to need a couple of amendments that I would like to offer.
Okay.
The heading, the fourth line down, after Department of Motor Vehicles, the amendment was delete and modifying the 2018 budget for the county shortfalls. That those words would be deleted. In the now, therefore, be it resolved, in the second line, almost to the very end, it says, starting with when the positions of motor vehicle clerk, I would like to amend the resolution to delete the words of motor vehicle clerks. And on the back page, I would move to amend decrease appropriations and the item number and the amount, $43,543, and the increase appropriations, the item number, the description, and the amount, $35,067. And ask that this board approve that amendment.
Mr. Timmerman. Mr. Timmerman seconds. As to the amendment, or the amendments, I should say, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And moving on to the resolution as amended, is there any discussion on this? Mr. Burke.
Yes, that's okay.
Other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to the county administrator's report. Not taking action on the two resolutions involving the public defender because he wasn't able to attend tonight.
Okay, I have a letter today received from the Office of Children and Family Services thanking the county for their thoughtful letter and receipt to them of the Raise the Age Local Planning Guide. They've indicated that now with an enacted state budget that they'll begin the next phase, which will allow them to look at the dollars associated with implementing this legislation. So I would say receiving a letter within 9 days of submitting anything to the state is a victory for us. It certainly shows that they're paying attention, that they're looking carefully at this, and my hope is that we'll also hear back from them on our plan very soon. To that end, on the enacted state budget, NYSAC is hosting another conference call tomorrow to review the impacts of the state budget, and I have asked and have started receiving impacts from our county departments about those implications, and if any require budget action, we'll bring those to you. But also, if there's any increases, we certainly would like that to bring that to your attention as well. And that's tomorrow afternoon. If anyone's interested in sitting in and listening to the call, I can get you the information. I want to remind you that financial disclosures to comply with the St. Lawrence County Ethics Law were due March 31st. So if you need any assistance completing these, let us know. We can make sure you get what you need so these can get over to the county attorney's office. Wanted to give you a brief update on courthouse security. So we had a visit from our friends at OCA who came in to talk about some of the impacts on security today and some of the unique issues is the word they always use with our courthouse. Implications associated with trying to move towards vertical security. Currently, the state staff on site here at the courthouse is not authorized to move to summer hours. Now, that would make it very difficult if, in fact, we are moving to an 8-to-4 scenario and court staff's coming in at 8:30 or 9 o'clock. It really would make vertical security ineffective. So we're waiting to hear both from the administrative law judge and any other communications from the district to find out if, in fact, we'll be moving to a matching schedule, which I would say always that I know of anyhow, the last 20 years have moved, though sometimes they delay, right up until the week before. So we'll keep you apprised of that. Certainly has complicated our endeavors trying to move this forward and get things moving, but we'll keep you updated on that. I wanted to give you the summary on the vacancy review committee. As I think I mentioned in the packets were handed out, 22 positions were reviewed. That was for 10 departments last week. I would like to mention that 7 of those positions were the summer temporary positions that Don hires, so that number may seem a bit higher than you're used to seeing, but that involves 7 of those positions, as well as the one we pulled from the board agenda that I went over with you to be filled in a permanent capacity rather than a temporary. Also, I wanted to mention, out of that group were 5 for the Public Health Department. Now, with Dana in place, almost 2 months now, she's been able to meet with staff and is making some recommendations for getting her staff up to full capacity. So there'll be some changes brought to you next week at services, but I think this will give her an opportunity to get everybody in place, and these will be her hires, which I think is also important as well. So far this year, we have 60 requests made and 52 approved, and that's a variety of the immediately, I believe there's 28, there are 20, there are 20 that were approved, or 12 for 30 days and 10 for 60 days. So we aren't moving as quickly as I'd like towards that place where we have more 60 days, but some of them, particularly public health, have been vacant for much longer than 60 days. So the appreciation of savings, I think, is something that, you know, is the goal of delaying those position fills. And finally, I wanted to mention that I was able today to participate in the Falcons Peak training at Fort Drum. That was a training exercise. Many of you might have seen some media on that. It included a trip from Wheeler Sack Airfield up to near Legislator Moore's airfield, if any of you are familiar with that. So we made the trip in a Black Hawk helicopter, which was a very interesting trip. So certainly being fearful of heights, I was nervous, but it was pretty impressive. It did remind me, and I think Chairman Akers as well, of what we take for granted that's happening less than 60 miles from here. A lot of activity every single day. While we sit at our desks and do our work or have meetings or, you know, move about our lives, we forget how much is happening to keep us safe. That's all I've got. Unless there's questions.
Okay. Is there Mr. Akers?
I'd like to make some follow-up comments. So we made the trip from the base to, and we did circle right over Mr. Moore's airport and or his landing area. And on the way back, so we went about 2,000 feet high on the way there. But on the way back, what they wanted to try out was actually going down into the ravines, over top the 25, 15 feet, over top the treetops. Because basically what's happening now is many of our adversaries have the same lethal capacities that we do. And so in the space of about 2-week period, that a Syrian helicopter, an F-16 jet that the Israelis had, and a Russian airliner, they all went down. And it was all basically by really, I won't say elementary means, but rather not complex means, handheld rockets and stuff like that that brought these planes down. So they know that there's another layer of complexity to this, so that this is what this training is. This exercise would be something that they would do if they were in Eastern Europe. And that was one of the things, unfortunately for Ruth on the trip that way, her headset was not working. So the guy that sat beside us on this Black Hawk was actually an instructor pilot. And so he was talking pretty much all the way through. And so they know that they have to adapt. And so part of that was the training that we had today, was going down into ravines, hovering over top like a swamp area, out of sight, and then popping up at different levels. And he talked about the 4 different levels with the Apache helicopters, then the Blackhawks, then the cargo planes, and then the really nasty really fast jets. So a multi-layered, multi-dimension. But just like Rue said, you know, we take this for granted. We go home tonight. We have a meal with our families. These people are working on a daily basis. This is their livelihood of actually making us secure, that we can have this meeting tonight and be discussing these really minor details. And one of the things that, and I may have just mentioned it, but that this terrain, he says, if you look out, it looks pretty flat. But he says, when you get down in there with all these ravines and streams and stuff, this is very much like Eastern Europe. and he emphasized how important it was to have this training facility here for the Army. So it was a real eye-opener, and was well attended to.
Is there any old business to come before the committee? Mr. Burke.
Last week, when we voted on the Bassmasters, information came up that I wasn't aware of before, and that was that the money that was allocated or will be allocated from the ESD funds was going back to pay the village or the town. I'm not sure which was said. But I went back through all of the budgets and failed to see where there was any notation that money had been borrowed in any of the previous Bassmaster events. I bring this up not because of the outcome of the vote. That's fine. I mean, I'm getting used to being in the minority, so that doesn't trouble me. But what troubles me is making sure that we have accurate information so that we can all make informed decisions. And again, I didn't see any notation in any of the previous budgets that were given to us that any money had been loaned. So I guess I'm of the belief, unless somebody can shed some light on it, I'm of the belief that when they get that $60,000 to $70,000, that will put them well in excess of the appropriations needed for the Bassmasters. And I think, Kevin, you're the one that said that maybe you could explain to me how that could happen. How could a budget be there without notating that, without any notation that money had been borrowed to pay back?
Mr. Akers.
Well, it's not easy to see that. I mean, it's not difficult to see that this is a volunteer organization, and financials was not their strong point. And they were given grants from the Senator Ritchie's office, totaling with the about around $70,000, I think is what it is. And I'm not delving into their finances because I don't know the specifics either. They, in order to receive those grants, they had to submit the bills, and they had not done so, John. So that money was there from 13, 15, and 17, I think is the three, that they actually, on a failure on their part, to actually complete the process. And so that is why I pulled the resolution, because I was made aware of that by a village trustee. And as you can see from the financials that Mr. Hooper's firm had submitted to us that were given to Don's coworker, that which were much more along the lines of what Mr. Hooper and Mr. Lightfoot wanted to see, that somebody was did the work for them. But what it is what you don't see is that the year that the Bassmasters lost $60,000, that $60,000 came out of an economic fund that the village of Waddington had. And so that will be, if they do and qualify, and I don't know if Ruth, if you've heard anything from John Vanderloo of ESD at all, whether that work, because we probably are coming on the time frame where those grants, if they are still eligible, will be coming back to the village. So if you looked at it, I think they made $60,000. I think there was a really strong fundraising effort. It cost about $200,000, if I recall, to put that tournament on. And then I believe that the next year was a small amount, and then they lost $60,000. And I just think that as a volunteer group, very small group, that they ran out of gas. And that's what's happening is that, and this is my belief, the $30,000 that was in the resolution that I brought forth was the entry fee. which previously had been $60,000, but the Bassmasters cut them a break because it's a small town and that they just held it last year. And they recognize we don't have the corporate sponsors up here that the Finger Lakes or around Lake Champlain or other areas of New York State have that will just put the money up. And I think in other communities, like in the Finger Lakes, when they held it here the year after ours, the first time here, they didn't, the organization didn't raise any money. It all came in from the vendors. So that's what it is. They did not submit the proper paperwork in a timely manner to receive those grants. I pulled the resolution because they had not done the work and said I would not submit it again until they had actually sent that information to this gentleman in Watertown. And Ruth spoke to the individual, and the work has been, the bills have been submitted, which I believe were in a paper sack. So if we're going to make this a fishing destination, obviously somebody else has, they have to start working together, whether it's the chamber or something else. And I think it's really important to us, and that's why I brought the resolution forth, that we continue on this path. Maybe we can get out of not supporting it. I know it was a struggle this time, but if we're going to make this something that can happen at least maybe every 2 years to benefit the St. Lawrence County, then we're going to have to be more organized. And because volunteers, they run out of gas. They get burnt out, they get disappointed, and people that have supported them in the past now are questioning whether or not that they should get the funding. I know there's an online thing about Bassmasters, and people are questioning, gosh, you know, what's wrong? It's been so successful there. We've had all this turnout. Why is the county in that kind of thing, you know, not supporting it, that type of thing? So I think there's a real opportunity. I'm thankful that we had 11 votes, and it was good discussion to make forth the effort. And I think really this is kind of an, I understand, John, your questions, but it's kind of an afterthought, but that's the best explanation that I can give you from the limited knowledge that I have about it, the financials.
Mr. Berg.
Thank you for that, Kevin. And again, it's not my intent to debate what's already been debated and what's already been voted on and what's already been decided. My concern is having accurate data so that we can all make our own decisions based on that data. And as I look back through 13, 15, 17, and each one of those years had a balance, showed that there was, whatever it cost, there was an equal amount of revenue, except 17. And they used that 60-some thousand dollars, from what I can see, that 60-some thousand dollars was used for 17 from the years prior, the 15 surplus of 60-some thousand dollars. I did not see where any money had been appropriated from the village or the town, unless that profit from that, from 15, had been put in an account with the town or village. I don't know that, but again, my concern is that when we do these things, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, and I sincerely hope we ask for a budget when the Bassmasters is done, so that we can see. I'd like to see if that $60,000 to $70,000 is indeed a surplus. There is nothing that I can see again on the three past Bassmasters or the current budget for this year that shows where any money had been borrowed. So I'm still of the belief that money will be surplus money. Maybe I'm wrong, but if anybody else can see it differently, I'd love to know. And again, the reason for bringing this up is that I think we all want to know that whatever decision we make is based upon fact and solid information. That's the reason I'm bringing it up. I'm not convinced that that, at least for my part, the information was solid.
Mr. Akers.
I understand John's concern, and they're valid. What's also not in there is the expenditures that the village contributed through the Department of Public Works, setting everything up, setting up the stage, and the various things. If you get down to it, we're not including, it's not in there, the county's contribution with the sheriff and other agencies too. So I understand it's valid. Maybe if Mr. Hooper would volunteer his firm, but he's retired, he could provide us with those, you know, something like that, forensic accounting, where it's people up here in the North Country are pulling together to make this happen, and they just made it happen. And I have to give them credit. They made it happen four times, you know. So, maybe the numbers don't line up. Maybe they're not in the right slot. Maybe something has not been accounted for. Maybe something has been accounted for twice. Who knows? So it's, to me, it's whether you believe in the possibilities and the potentials of what has taken place. Not discounting anything that you've said, John, on the financials. I gave you a little bit more information that was told me, you know, like we should actually see what's the village contribution. I don't believe Waddington, from what I've seen, is getting rich on this. I know they can't charge for the music. They can't charge admission. There are three main businesses that generate between Canoco, the bowling alley, and Charlo's. Those are the recipients of the, and then in the direct community of the village of Waddington. And then it spreads out to Potsdam, the people are saying Potsdam. I think it was Mr. Hooper that mentioned he went to the smokehouse in Madrid. It was full of fishermen talking fish stories about how their day was and that kind of thing. So it spreads out. The fishermen, the organizers stayed in Messina, I believe the last time. I think this time they're going to try Potsdam. That's 30 rooms that this Bassmasters tournament through the village of Waddington, they have the money that they raise. So yeah, it's not, you know, maybe the accounting that we would all like to see to make this decision, but it is what it is. Ruth, I don't know, can you give us an update on the ESD monies?
I have not heard. I believe that what we had looked at was about the beginning of May. Be around the time. We certainly could ask if there's a copy of what was submitted. So anytime you receive a grant, you put in the reimbursement, the receipts, up to however much you can account for. So we could certainly request a copy of that and find out what the totals are and where it came from.
And I'll follow up just a little bit on this, saying that what we saw as presented as financial statements was really a cash receipts journal and a cash disbursements journal for each of the three events. And I know where John is coming from, because the second event showed a surplus of $60,000+, and the third event was underwater by about the same amount. And I don't recall any discussion at any time about the village needing to be repaid. But as I did finally vote after sitting on the fence, I voted yes, because I thought it was for the greater good of the county. These are good events, and there's a lot of interest in seeing them continue. That said, is there any new business to come before the committee? Seeing none, we do have a need for executive session for negotiations, litigation, personnel, and appointments. So Mr. Timmerman, seconded by Mr. Fay, all in favor of proceeding into executive session? Aye. Opposed? We'll go into executive session.